Good morning, be seated, please.
Hold the gate.
First case on our calendar is 98-913, State of Ohio versus Joseph Green. Mr. Cockles.
Well, these people came to see you today. Well, these people came to see you today.
See me?
Yeah.
No, but good to see you.
We have advanced 20 propositions of law before this court. I would like to begin with proposition of law 3, which flat out asks that this court reverse its prior decision in State versus McGuire and reimpose the doctrine of reasonable doubt in the second phase of the capital case as set forth in State versus McGuire. When I say we, I don't necessarily mean Joseph Green and counsel. In this case, there was a very powerful message delivered by a three-judge panel in this case.
That surprised me in this case, a three-judge panel making the statements they did and saying that simply because we had overruled the idea of residual doubt in McGuire that they had to impose the death penalty. Very strange that a three-judge panel would even consider the issue of residual doubt. How do you address that?
Well, very simply, Your Honor, it's a powerful message from that three-judge panel to the court. I think it was addressed to Mr. Green. It's very little comfort to Mr. Green that the three-judge panel would have given him life imprisonment but for some obscure case by...
Well, I don't think you're seeing my point. A three-judge panel was hearing this case. A three-judge panel, certainly, if that's the penalty that they wanted to impose, could have done so.
Yes.
Why would they have to rely on a theory of residual doubt?
Because in this case, and I think that if you read the opinion after the first phase, they never do reach the issue of principal offense. They find that Mr. Green was guilty of committing the offense of aggravated murder, or at least the murder in the course of the kidnapping, the robbery, two of the attendant specifications on counts 4, 5, and 6, the aggravated murder counts. They do not reach the principal offender issue, finding it unnecessary. In the second phase, listening to the evidence, they were, of course, convinced of Mr. Green's involvement. I think you can read that opinion as, at a rock bottom minimum, they considered that Mr. Green was a complicit to this homicide. But when they come to the second phase, they feel hamstrung by McGuire in the sense that they can't consider what they found in this case to be some question in their minds over Mr. Green's role in this offense. In other words, was he the shooter or not the shooter? And that is where they focus their, for lack of a better word, discomfort with McGuire in the sense that they didn't have a problem with whether he was involved in this. I think they were pretty satisfied that he was involved in this. Their discomfort was at the level of his culpability. And they construed McGuire. And if they're wrong, then I wish this court would tell them they're wrong and remand it and ask them to reconsider. But if they are wrong, if they consider they felt they could not consider that degree of discomfort they had on whether he was a shooter or not.
Now, they only have that discomfort in the penalty phase. Obviously, they found it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Indeed, they did. But I'm suggesting that they found him beyond reasonable doubt, at least at rock bottom, as a complicit. He was guilty. They're satisfied he was guilty. Where the discomfort and where
they were... But they never found him to be the principal offender beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, they did not. And the reason they did it is because they felt, as they say in their opinion, that it was unnecessary to go to that extra step because they found him the murder to have been committed in the course of an aggravated robbery and kidnapping.
Well, but you're missing one step there. They found prior calculation and design.
Yes, they did.
It has to be one or the other. They did it.
Indeed, they did, Your Honor.
Okay, so if it's prior calculation and design, and maybe the question is more difficult to answer than it would appear to me to be, but I have the same problem that Justice Resnick did, and maybe I'll try to phrase it a different way. They had all the options under the statute to give whatever penalty they wanted to, didn't they?
Certainly they did.
Okay, so there's no requirement, unless they found that aggravation outweighs mitigation, regardless of reasonable doubt, regardless of anything, unless they found that, they didn't have to give the death penalty.
That's correct.
Okay, so why would they say the Supreme Court made us do it?
Well, again, as I replied to Justice Douglas, I was the same thing. Maybe they felt wrongly hamstrung by McGuire. Maybe they misconstrued McGuire. And if indeed they did misconstrue McGuire, then I would ask this court to remand it to them, tell them, that's, you got it all wrong. That's not how we intended McGuire to be.
But even if you took, even if you accepted the proposition on reasonable doubt, which is something we could debate for a long time as we did it among ourselves, but even if you accept the proposition that reasonable doubt is a mitigating factor, you're still in the same position of being able to give the death penalty or not, depending on what you find. Are you saying that they're saying that if they add residual doubt, that that would have been enough to overturn the death penalty?
No, I'm not saying that. They're saying that. They say...
Are you saying that's what they said?
That is what they say. They say, but for McGuire, we would have imposed a sentence of life imprisonment. Those aren't my words. I'm not trying to put my spin on what they said.
So the reasonable doubt would have been the other weight on the scale to balance aggravation against mitigation.
Absolutely. I think what they're suggesting in their panel opinion is signed by the panel, they refer throughout the opinion as the panel. So I think it's a unanimous reflection of all three views, all three judgments. They say that it's in the appendix here, so on page 14 of our appendix, they say that, but for the McGuire decision, the resulting penalty for capital murder count and specification would have been life without the possibility of parole instead of death.
If a judge or a jury has in their mind residual doubt about whether or not the crime was committed, doesn't that equate to acquittal? I mean, how can you say, well, I have some doubt that this alleged offender, committed this act. I have some doubt about that, but guilty anyway.
Well, that's not what they're saying here.
No, but I mean, isn't that the concept of residual doubt? That's why we struggled with it.
I think the concept of residual doubt is in many ways similar, not what I would say similar to reasonable doubt, but it is a fluid concept that could be or can be adapted to the circumstances of each case. There are some cases where there is no residual doubt. There is no question who it was. There's no question what the motive was. There's no question the means of death. None of those issues are in question. In this case, there is no question that Mr. Green was involved in this offense, according to the panel. They were satisfied beyond reasonable doubt on that. There's no question that he was present. The question that they had, where they had a problem, was whether or not he was the shooter. That's really what it comes down to. And to them, In their mind, if he wasn't the shooter, that to them was powerful mitigation evidence. Would have been a powerful factor in mitigation that would have tipped the scales to a life without the possibility of
counsel. I think the question is, that if the panel felt if he's the shooter, he should get that. If he's not the shooter, he should not. Is that what they're trying to say?
I think so. Again, right. they don't say that when I'm ambiguous.
They don't need to use resistance that way. If they're unconvinced,
exactly.
That he's the shooter, they can just use that as a factor to weigh in their weight process.
According to the panel,
if the scales is in the white expression, we have this list of aggravating mitigating circumstances, but it's in the eye of the beholder. That's what the prior fact of the jury or the pre-judge panel ultimately
comes down to their best judgment whether or not death should be imposed.
Now, apparently, reading the amendment, they didn't feel they had that.
Do you read the, when you get to the sentencing phase, that it is so mechanical that it's, the outcome is just automatic, that there's no judgment involved?
In the panel opinion?
No.
Or in the phase itself?
In the phase and in what the statute provides. If there's no room for judgment, it is just these factors and these factors, and it's obvious to everyone.
Well,
how the scales tips in every case.
I understand what the court said. I understand what you're asking. Each case, of course, is different. And in some cases, you're able to convince the trier of fact one way or another, depending on the circumstances of the case.
But the statute certainly contemplates the exercise of some judgment, some, for everything that these jurors or the three panelists bring to the table in their life experience after they've heard all of the case and all about the defendant.
But
looked at the factors to be weighed, that they make a call.
So I think Justice Spicer, what the panel's saying is that they feel that the court's decision in McGuire is preventing them from making that step that you're suggesting that they have the authority to make. In other words, they feel McGuire is a roadblock that prevents them from going that next step. There's no other way of reading that opinion, because I agree with
you. Do you think that the absence of residual doubt as a principal factor makes it impossible to consider weighing aggravation and mitigation the fact that the trial of fact is unconvinced the defendant is the shooter?
I think so, and more importantly in this case, three judges of the common pleas court, Lucas County, thought so.
You don't think that can be considered?
They don't. I think it could be considered. I would try to argue it as much as I could in the trial phase.
Yes, even with McGuire.
Even though, to the extent that I would tell them to stop talking, I'll try to do that in any trial. But these three judges felt they're reading McGuire that they couldn't go that way. They were basically precluded from. B7 says any other evidence relevant. This court has said the defendant has wide latitude bringing that evidence forward. What I think what this panel is saying is that wide latitude is not as wide as it's been brought in. And brought in to question of degree, and brought in to question of steps, whatever metaphor you'd like to use. But in some way, G7 has been cut back for them to prevent them.
Yeah, but here you acknowledge that the residual doubt really is present in terms of guilt.
It's not.
So it's hard for us to understand that bringing up the issue of residual status is residual debt.
Counsel.
That's why residual status is developed in McGuire related to guilt.
Counsel, did I hear you just say that no matter what McGuire says, you would still argue residual doubt?
No, that's not what I said.
I think you did.
Well, I said I was trying to bring forth issues such as whether he's the shooter or not.
Don't you agree that McGuire does away with residual doubt?
Oh, in this state, absolutely, yes.
In any case?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So, when you said that you would argue residual doubt, what did you mean?
No, I didn't say I'd argue residual doubt. If I said that, I misspoke. What I said is that I would argue distinctions for whether the person was the shooter or not. I wouldn't mention the word residual doubt, and I wouldn't argue that I wouldn't question the jury's confidence in their verdict, but I would say, as a mitigating factor, this person was not the shooter.
I thought McGuire did away with residual doubt.
It does do away with it.
But why are we even mentioning it then? It's no longer an issue.
Well...
Is it?
No, it isn't an issue.
Well, you've argued for 12 minutes on residual doubt.
Well, I think we're asking this court to overrule its prior decision in McGuire.
This court that just handed that down in 1997.
That's correct.
The court was composed as it is today.
Absolutely.
I see.
Well, I suppose...
And I'm not the only one, again, as I stress, I'm not the only one. There's
three judges in Lewis County, well, nearly one-third of the entire general division of the The question that...
Are you saying that the three judges felt that residual doubt was still something that they could consider?
No, they didn't. They said that could they consider it, they would have considered it. And had they considered it, they would have returned a sentence.
Why would they even say that?
Maybe it's a symbol of their frustration with the court's ruling to write. Maybe it's a signal...
They don't have to rely on residual doubt to find an issue wasn't proven.
Well, I understand that argument, and I really wish that maybe the three judges had taken your approach, but they didn't, and here we are.
Well, I'm a little mystified taking my approach. Doesn't everyone have to say that residual doubt is out as far as the law is concerned?
That's exactly what they're saying in this panel.
It's not just my approach, is it?
No.
That's the law.
That's correct.
Actually, they said more than that in the opinion. That's probably the reason it's being argued so. They went on and said this bright line rule overruling earlier decisions in the view of this panel is wrong-headed to the point where one day somebody innocent is going to be executed. Now, my question is, they issued the opinion pursuant to the statute. They also entered a separate verdict and judgment entry.
That's correct. I got the first page.
Okay. That verdict and judgment entry, if I read it right, says, having done so, that is, finally listening to the arguments of counsel and so on, this panel unanimously finds the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt all the essential elements of count 4 of this indictment, aggravated murder, in that the killing of Okaidi was committed purposely by the defendant. Is that what they're saying?
Exactly.
That the defendant himself did it.
That's what they're saying.
All right. Now, if they're saying that, where does the even if we had residual doubt, where does it come in?
Yeah.
Where does it come in when they do it on page 13 of their opinion, saying it'd be incomplete, however, if they didn't add a few words in this opinion about the impact wrought on the resulting sentence by the Ohio Supreme Court's recent ruling in McGuire, and then they talk about, by the way, a 7-2. I see seven of us here, not nine, right? That's the other part of their opinion. 7-2, it wasn't a 7-2 vote, it was 5-2, right? Okay. And then they go on and talk about us being wrong-headed and all of that. How does that add up when they found in their own entry that he purposely killed the victim?
Well, because in that same entry, they didn't reach where they found the residual doubt in the second phase, and they had it on principal offender. As I suggested, that opinion, I think, could be construed as a reflection of their view that Mr. Green was present, he took part in the planning, he was there at every step of the way, but he was not the one that actually fired the shot.
Oh, so the language, you're saying that the language that the victim, the crime, the killing of the victim, was committed purposely by the defendant, Joseph Green, and with prior calculation design, doesn't mean that he was the principal offender.
I think that's exactly what they're saying, a complicitor is just as responsible as the person committing the act. That's a well-established principle. And I think that panel opinion from the first phase is a reflection of that well-established principle. Where they had the problem in the second phase was whether or not he actually pulled the trigger. But they felt if they made that finding in the first phase, they couldn't consider any other aspect of his culpability.
If we would reverse his vacate the death sentence and send it back for another hearing on the death sentence and say you can consider residual doubt, do they give him life imprisonment without parole?
That's what they said.
They didn't quite say that, did they?
I think they said it.
Where?
They said it must be noted. It must also be noted, however, this is on page 14 of the appendix.
Uh-huh.
It must also be noted that, however, that but for the McGuire decision, the resulting penalty for the capital murder count specification would have been life without the possibility of parole instead of death. And this is an unambiguous, I couldn't have written it better.
I agree, that's what they say in their opinion.
That's right.
But that's not what they've said in their judgment entry. Their judgment entry said he purposely was the offender. Okay, let's accept what you've said, though. Then, didn't they also have that option, life without the possibility of parole, regardless of anything else,
at
the time it was before them?
That's correct. Yes. They had that option. They also had the option of 25 or 30.
So they could have chosen that without all of this.
Correct. There's something else about this panel opinion. As I suggested earlier, it's obviously a statement by three judges. It does, though, I think, in some respects, beg a question of how many other judges in this common police court judges in the state have the same reservations about McGuire. They're the ones that are actually hearing these cases at the trial level. And it's highly unusual, at least in this state system, for me to find somebody pressing outrage at a Supreme Court ruling. I find it in the federal system all the time when they talk about guidelines, but in the state system it's unusual to see this kind of language. It, to me, suggests that there may be some other judges in the county.
You have some other very important issues. I wish you would proceed to those, and that would be the, how they weighed the aggravating circumstances and the mitigating circumstances, and also the issue of allocution. I'd like to address those issues.
Did Mr. Green wasn't permitted to speak? It's our view that he was permitted to speak as to the counts for which he entered the plea of guilty, but he wasn't permitted to speak as to the counts in which he wasn't, as to the homicide count. I think you said it for us fairly clearly in the brief, Your Honor.
That strong language about us and what they don't do.
Now, do you think that a death penalty case is a little bit different as to allocution? Could it ever be looked at differently because of the fact of the mitigation hearing where a defendant is given an opportunity to make any statements he wants during that mitigation period? Or do you think that in a death penalty case, the right of allocution must be accorded?
Well, the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said that, and the safeguards are increased in the context of the death penalty case. I don't think that this court can find, under these facts, that the lack of the right of allocution was harmless error. And any structural defect, then you have to be able to have the individual say something. Rule 32 says if you are permitted to say something, and I would suggest that this court should find the same way.
Why? Because they find it in their entry that he did.
That clearly only non-capital issues could be that opportunity.
Yes, there were two distinct crimes.
One involving the same offender, but it says purpose that he did.
Mr. Norby entered the plea of guilty pursuant to the counsel for regarding Mr. Moore. Those were scheduled for sentencing, I think, the following day or a day or two following when the panel returned its opinion as to the second day. The panel asked counsel, can we just take care of Mr. Moore now until it comes back in a couple of days? And basically said yes. Anything from the counsel, and it was really only in remarks with reference towards whether the suspects merged, and the court said yes, they do. Anything from Mr. Green, and Mr. Green said he didn't have anything to say. Then he said, now the court will now move on to the case for which they were hearing, with the homicide. They pronounced their sentence, never gave him a particular record. It just wasn't there. I don't think that's in dispute.
Mr. Green never wrote a letter separately to the judge with his expression of his issue, right?
It's not in the record. If he did, it's not in the record. We also, obviously, brought other issues. Another issue was the lack of a on-the-record hearing for the competency issue regarding one of the witnesses, Rosa Crusher. In what the panel described as a highly circumstantial case, one of the witnesses, Rosie Crusher, testified that she observed someone who she described as Mr. Green fire a shot or at least see a gun at the time when the victim was killed. That testimony of hers was supported by records. However, her competency was called into question by defense counsel. Medical records from the mental health professionals were obtained, and the trial court, just one of the three judges, only one of the judges, in chambers with the defense counsel and counsel for the state, no defendant, no co-reporter, discussed the matter in this Russian conference at some length. Upon emerging from chambers, the trial judge stated that Having spoken with Ms. Thrusher based on my observations from this hearing, as well as the deposition that had been held a few months prior, as well as a review of the records, I find her competent to testify, stating they called her witness more or less as what would happen. It's our position that the trial court committed error by not having an on-the-record hearing at which that competency was determined.
Was it requested by the defense or by the prosecution that that be on the record?
It wasn't requested by anyone on the record. In other words, there's nothing on the record one way or another about who asked for it to be in chambers, how it got to be in chambers, why it wasn't recorded. There's absolutely nothing on the record.
You didn't complain at the time, but now you're complaining that it's not on the record.
That's correct.
Isn't that called waiver?
Well, I call it plain error. This court may call it waiver.
To be plain error, of course, we'd have to say that, but for not having that examination, the result would be different. Could Ms. Thrusher's testimony be seen as outcome determinative?
Yes, that's correct.
You think?
And in this case, the panel, as I indicated, and throughout the opinion in both cases, refers to what they call circumstantial evidence. This particular case, Ms. Thrusher's testimony, was permitted the state to introduce not only placing Mr. Green at the scene of the homicide, it also permitted them to bring in supporting evidence in terms of phone records. Ms. Thrusher said she went out to make a telephone call. While she was making the telephone call, she was able to observe what was going on. They permitted them not only to bring in that identification testimony, which wasn't really strong, but was obviously strong enough, but it also permitted them to bring in kind of depth by way of her testimony about the phone call and supporting that phone call by use of phone records, showing that yes, she did make a phone call to that particular number at that particular time. Without that, then what they had was Mr. Green in the car of the victim. With little else at that point.
Were there not casings there? Were there shell casings
there
at that?
But from being in what everybody can agree is a stolen car to finding them being the murderer just because they're in that car, that's a pretty long leap. I would suggest that without Ms. Thrusher's testimony, the court may have had a more difficult time finding a guilty verdict as to the aggravated murder down to all the counts relating to this case. Possibly not receiving stolen property from the long. We also raised in Proposition 1 and 10 the adequacy of the jury waiver. This would, of course, once again, the court is supposed to revisit a prior decision. This one would be State versus Jones. In this case, there's a little bit of a difference here. Because I think the trial court, in accepting Mr. Green's plea of guilty on the murder, recognized that there was the additional safeguards in addition to Rule 11 are required. In addition to the safeguards set forth in Rule 11, when he accepted Mr. Green to plead guilty the Moore murders, he also went forward to say that he also realized that you're giving up very many valuable appellate rights by entering this plea of guilty, specifically the right to appeal any objection rulings, a whole host of issues the trial judge mentioned, and said, as is the case, as is the law, the reviewing court would be limited to only the adequacy of my plea, the taking of this plea, which is, again, a direct statement of law. When he accepted the jury waiver from Mr. Green, shortly afterward, he didn't go into the appellate issues that would be waived by, or the, not necessarily waived, but wouldn't be available, is a better way of expressing it, the appellate issues that wouldn't be available if the case was heard by a pre-judge panel as opposed to a jury. This court last year in State versus Baskin, I interpret to be a little seed suggesting that maybe a more extensive inquiry should be required in accepting the jury waiver. And I would think this would apply not only to capital cases, but all cases where there's a jury waiver. It's a Sixth Amendment right, it's a very fundamental right to, I think the full consequences of a jury waiver
should be addressed by a court with the defendant prior to accepting a waiver of that Sixth Amendment right. I think that's absolutely necessary to protect the rights of the defendant. In this case, it's more pronounced because of the trial court telling Mr. Green in taking his guilty plea on the Warner case that you were given up a whole lot of potential appellate issues by giving this plea of guilty. But he didn't go as far in accepting the jury waiver. And I would suggest that's highly significant. And it provides this court with an opening to require the trial courts to gain in a more extensive colloquy with the criminal defendants before they permit the waiver of the right to jury trial. In proposition of law number 12, we raised a proposition of law with regard to one of the three judges that heard this case also heard a Rule 16 certification hearing. In this court, State v. Miller said that it is highly improper. In fact, the trial judge, the judge that actually heard this Rule 2
Just finish your thought.
The trial judge that heard that recognized that under Giller, the trial court couldn't hear it, and somebody else had to hear it, and he was hearing it, and later said on that panel, and we would suggest for reasons set forth in the brief, that that is a mandate reversal.
Thank you, Mr. Kukovic. Mr. Wegler. Somewhere down here, and when we're talking about someone's life, there's something in between, and that's residual doubt, not guilt, but when we're considering whether someone should be put to death, the residual doubt is the doctrine that says we have to be careful, and that's the reason, that's the basis for residual doubt.
I understand that and what you're talking about is once you reach the level, you certainly be on a higher degree of certainty, but there's no way of determining a higher degree. I mean, once you're sure of something, you're sure of something, it seems to me. I mean, I don't want to argue the point of a residual doubt. I would hazard a guess as to the court's reason for putting that disclaimer in the opinion in regard to why. I don't know why that disclaimer was put in there. But the court clearly found that there was prior calculation of dishonor. The court clearly found that he was involved in this offense. And all we have to do in order to deter the conduct of Mr. Green is look at the survivor of the first case, David Moore. And we know exactly what these people were going to do. Mr. Moore was never a threat when he was abducted and was gone. Never a threat. Totally cooperative. Driven to a remote area. Told to get out of the car. Got out of the car and was shot immediately. And much to his surprise, he was still alive and he was able to run and ran. And he was chased down by Joseph Green. Who chased him down, shot him three more times, and then when Mr. Moore fell on the ground, walked up right behind him and shot him in the back of the head. The same mistake was not made with Samara Lowe when she was killed. Because when she was killed, after being abducted by the same two people, she was shot face on from about 10 to 12 inches away, right between the middle of her eyes. Now, these two people carried out their scheme twice within a period of less than 2 weeks. It's also important that when Joseph Green and Douglas Carpenter were 14 years old, which was approximately 4 years, they were in another carjacking in which the person was also in a position to stay alive. They were convicted in that case, and the person was Marlon Brewster, one of their cousins. So they did
exactly.
Once you're sure somebody's guilty, You can't revisit that and say, well, but maybe it was a Martian. I mean, that's possible. I mean, you just can't, you can't keep beating that bush. They have plenty of opportunity under the statute to consider all those human factors that are available to us as human beings when it comes to making a decision as to whether or not someone should live or die. It's not an easy decision to make. It certainly wasn't an easy decision for these judges to make, but the simple fact of the matter is that the facts of this case were so compelling that they did it in spite of their consciences. And I think that that was just, that last shot was something to say if only things were a little bit different in this case, if the facts weren't as egregious as they are, we might have extended some mercy to this guy if we had that excuse of residual doubt hanging around.
Would you address the issue in Proposition of Law 4, defense counsel raises the issue concerning the indictment where it alleges that attempting to commit kidnapping or aggravated robbery, alleging that the judges did not consider both.
There were three counts in the indictment relating to the homicide. One, count three, alleged prior calculation of design with specification. Count four, an alleged prior calculation of design with the specification of committing aggravated robbery or kidnapping. Count five, separate count in the indictment, alleged aggravated robbery with a specification that said aggravated robbery or kidnapping.
Or kidnapping.
Right. And then count six said kidnapping, aggravated murder, of course, but kidnapping, and the specs said while committing aggravated robbery or kidnapping. Court made three specific findings as to each count. Count four, it said guilty, prior calculation, design. But it also made determinations in count five and six. Five related to the aggravated robbery, six related to the aggravated murder. So they are excuse me.
Kidnapping.
They made the specific findings that the spec for each of those two counts, aggravated robbery and kidnapping, was the same. They said in count five, aggravated robbery and the principal offense, aggravated robbery and the spec. Count six, same thing. Kidnapping in the principal offense, kidnapping in the spec. Then they merged those two counts as they're required to do with count four and said, we find him guilty of aggravated murder with prior calculation of design in the process of committing aggravated robbery and aggravated murder.
Both.
Both.
Even though the indictment.
Separate counts for each, and it's a very logical thing to say that when you merge that, you have to include both of them since both alternatives were available in count four.
But then when they did the weighing, they used both kidnapping and aggravated robbery as separate aggravating circumstances.
And I think they're entitled to do that because they've made.
Not if you merged them.
I beg your pardon?
Not if you've merged them.
Well, but they're required to merge them. I mean, they have made separate findings of both the offense and the spec for the aggravated robbery and the aggravated murder. They've made both of those specific findings. And to say that the word or can't be construed conjunctively is improper in that situation because there's no logical way that they can say we've made this finding separately on these two other things and therefore we can only find one on count four. In the process of merging as they're required to do, they're entitled to take those separate findings and incorporate them into the merger so that the merger makes sense and it's consistent with what they've determined the facts to be.
On that same issue that Justice Resnick raises, their proposition of law 4 and 5, I can see your argument that they were charged separately and so they found them separately and then joined them for the weighing. But what about the A3 specification? It was never alleged at all, and they found that as a factor aggravating circumstance. That is, the killing for was carried out to execute a potential witness.
Correct.
And that was never even indicted.
It was not charged. It was certainly proven.
But it was never charged.
That's correct.
But the panel, after complaining about all the things that we've done,
yes,
then decides something here that isn't even in the case.
I think...
Isn't that fair?
I don't know how this transpired. I have no idea how this error occurred. It's an error.
Okay.
I mean, they're wrong when they say that there was a spat relating to this. The question is whether or not in the weighing process that they engaged in, and in the weighing process that this court engages in with respect to this issue, that the question is that error harmless error?
I present a different question, and that's why I was going to that issue. Let's assume that there is a distinction between the word or and in the previous argument, and you've conceded that this is a clear error. Can we correct those errors in our reweighing process?
I think you can.
Regardless of the other item you were talking about.
Well, I think so. I don't see that as a problem at all. Under the case law, you know, obviously this court has broad discretion in these cases, and I don't think that this court is in any fashion in reweighing these matters.
But in writing an opinion in this case, we would we not have to say that there never was an A3 charge in this case?
I don't think it's possible to write the opinion without saying that.
Thank you.
But I would like to emphasize that the court is right factually, but it's wrong about that language. I hate to say it, but I think that may be a function of the 20th century and data processing equipment and a mistake. You know, those things happen, and it's really unfortunate that they happen in a situation.
How about the trial court and their sentencing opinion comparing and contrasting the Moore offenses at long length with the Sammer killing? That's clearly error, isn't it?
Well, I think not.
He was separately sentenced for the Moore issues.
Well, I think it's necessary to talk about that, though, in order to talk about the nature and circumstances of the case. Because the information from the Moore case, in fact, shows the behavior of these people during the LOP case. The only witness in the LOP case, other than the two defendants, was murdered.
I agree.
And what we know is what the surviving potential murder victim told us is exactly how they...
But what we also know is the cold, hard documents that we have in front of us, and there was no course of conduct specification per A5 ever indicted or charged, was there?
No, that's right.
And yet that's what they used in Wayne.
Well, in part. I don't think that's quite
no?
accurate description. I think that's more something relating to the nature and circumstances and the offense that they're taking into consideration.
Well, what they said in part is the Moore incidents are hauntingly evocative of the facts surrounding the offenses against Samar.
Right.
Both were hijacked, both were forced. Weren't they comparing the two when he was only on trial for the aggravated murder of Samar?
But the evidence adduced at that trial included the evidence relating to the Moore case. Even though the defendant had pled to those offenses, the court still properly allowed the state to introduce the evidence from the Moore case because it was relevant as the motive, plan, scheme, and identity. And because of that evidence was relevant. And I think the court's consideration in that is not inappropriate.
Regardless of any indictment under A5.
Yeah, in spite of that. That's correct. I don't think an A5 indictment is required.
To prove course of conduct in an aggravated murder, it's not required?
No, to show motive, intent, plan, and scheme.
Well, you can do that under the rule. You can do that under the rule, generally.
Right.
But the General Assembly must have put A5 in there for some reason.
Oh, sure. They put A3 too.
Which was violated also.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. The one other thing I wanted to mention in regards to Rosen's question relates to a statement that Mr. Jacobus made about when these people were found, Coley and Green, when they were arrested on January 7th at 1:30 in the morning or thereabouts. When they were stopped, murder weapon was in the car. The same weapon that was used in Warren homicide, Warren shooting, and the Elbothian homicide was found in the car. Rosie Crusher was not making a phone call when she heard it shot. She was on her way to a phone call. She was in the alley right behind her house. She looked to her left. She saw a gray vehicle with long taillights, is how she described it. Matched the all of these vehicles that these people were picked up in on January 7th. They were driving the victim's car just as they had done in the previous case. They had more driving the victim's car. Murder weapon was in the car with the two of them. And they attempted to escape at the time that we stopped. With respect to the question about allocution, I would indicate to the court that there was clearly an invitation by the court for anyone to speak during the course of the trial and the mitigation phase. Not only did the relatives of the defendants testify at the hearing, but Dr. Julie Brahms testified for almost 5 hours, perhaps even longer than that, in regard to the defendant providing background information to the court relating to Mr. Green.
But the rule specifically specifies that the court shall address the defendant and say, do you have anything to say? Doesn't it?
I understand.
And did that happen here?
It did not happen here.
Another error of the trial court.
That is an error by the trial court. And I think that's, it's eminently curable if in fact this court determines that to be a factor that rises above the level of harmless error.
It's curable by sending it,
Davis,
returning, what about returning it back to the trial court and having them do it right?
Yes, and that happened previously in State versus Davis. I mean, that's exactly what happened in that case. I mean, the case was sent back to the trial court. It's a three-judge panel. The three judges are still alive. They can conduct this hearing again and ask him if he has anything to say before a sentence is imposed and this court feels that that's appropriate.
This is the second case you may know, the second case you've had in recently in which the trial court did not provide allocution. It seems to me we need to somehow let the trial courts know that this rule is mandatory. The obligation is on the court. It's not a situation where somebody offers evidence and there's no objection to it, it shouldn't come in. This is a specific express rule that tells the court you have the obligation to speak directly to the defendant and give the defendant the opportunity to speak with you or sensing as you know. That's why it's easy to just let it slip by. Well, you know, the defendant didn't say he wanted to talk, so we won't worry about it.
I appreciate the argument. As far as the rule is concerned, you're exactly right. At this point, I don't have anything more to say.
Along the same procedural
care
to the other question, and that is, how do you read what they said on were they saying we could consider we're not certain because the shooter
is their
life? Is that what they were saying?
They were wrong. I mean, if that's what they were saying, they were wrong. They were wrong in feeling they could consider. Now, they're wrong in feeling they couldn't. Now, they were wrong.
Read this.
They First of all, it couldn't make any difference whether he was the shooter or not, because they found him prior to the arrest.
Right, in terms of guilt, right.
Now,
I'm talking the penalty phase. I mean, how are we to take what they're saying? Are they saying, but for our inability to consider our doubt as to the fact that he's a shooter, we wouldn't impose the death penalty, if that's what they're saying? And isn't that wrong? So if that's wrong, do we have to send it back and say,
now you see why I'm exercising?
Why are they really preventing you from putting that on the table in this waive process?
I know that was picking.
I think what the judge is saying is, we're doing what we have to do because the law requires it to be done, and we wish we didn't have to do this because we'd like to have a way out, and the lawyer used to give it to us, and it does say that we're going to do what the law requires, and we're going to do our sentencing to death.
Okay, but if you're setting where we're setting, this is a little hard to figure exactly what they are saying there, and if you're setting where the defendant's setting, you have a whole different take altogether. The defendant's sitting there thinking, they were wrong about not being able to consider this, and they seem to be saying, if we can consider this, we think it tips the scales in favor of life instead of death.
Well, I don't think they're right in saying that McGuire precluded them from reaching a decision that involved a life sentence. I don't think they're right in
that
regard.
Right.
They could have reached whatever decision they wanted to reach in regard to this case, just like a jury is free to do under subsection 7. I mean, anything else that is relevant to the issue is something that they can take into consideration. And taking all those factors into consideration, they said, yeah. And then they're two at this point. And in a, I view, whining fashion, they said, but if we could use this excuse, we would have jumped on it, and we may not have ordered death in this case.
I guess I have the same problem that others have. Is that why is it death or nothing? I mean, why not life without parole or some other sentence? I mean, McGuire, I don't agree with it, but McGuire doesn't require them to order death, does he?
No, it doesn't. No, I think the problem in this case, Your Honor, I mean, is that these judges found that the nature of this offense, the aggravating circumstances in this offense, so outweigh the mitigating evidence that was presented, that they had no choice but to say that beyond reasonable doubt, death is appropriate because the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors.
But if they had residual doubt in their own mind, I mean, jurors are recommending life without parole. Who knows why? Maybe
sure.
Because they have a little doubt about this person. Yeah, we think he's guilty, but it's not no doubt. I mean, I guess I don't understand why the tongue lashing to the court and acting as if the court has required them to do this when it hasn't. McGuire doesn't require them to do that, to impose death sentence.
I think at most it prohibits arguing that issue from counsel,
right,
or the
right
court instructing on that issue.
Exactly.
But as human beings, that's an issue that's always going to be there, and as human beings, they had a perfect right to look at that and say, all right, we got this up in the back of our minds, and we're not sure that the aggravating circumstances outweigh what I'm trying to say.
Wait a minute. mitigating factors, but...
I think that's...
Thank you, Mr. Wigley. Mr. Hukovitz, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you. I will only say that the discussion about Proposition Law 4 and 5 highlight our due process concerns. It tells this court how different the first and second phases are. The discussion about the specifications, bringing in the more in the second phase, also highlights the due process concerns because the state got rearranged facts. And the second phase is not permitted to rearrange facts of the defense, the appeal, and they're able to say how bad this person is in terms of the appeal. So what I would suggest, I think that the panel is saying this, so I can answer your question, that they're saying that they don't think what the shooter or not is mitigating factor. If this court is indeed going to send this case back to the trial court, so we hear from Mr. Green, I would appreciate, and I think the panel as well, some direction on just whether a person's a shooter or not, if that is a mitigating factor in part of the waiting process. I think the state suggested that it can be, but I think that maybe this court ought to clear up that confusion, because obviously the confusion is particularly in the opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Corbis. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.